sounds like a story to me. Some crazy fable that you would not believe.
Oh, but ain't you... Welcome to the Avram Davidson Universe, where we listen to some of the greatest stories ever written. Adored by Ursula Le Guin, Neil Gaiman, Leonard Nimoy, Ray Bradbury, and Stephen King. Enjoy classic tales such as Are All the Seas with Oysters, The Golem, Sources of the Nile, and many others. Hey, everybody. I am fired up about this episode of the Avram Davidson Universe. Today, we're going to be speaking with Jack Seabrook. And I found Jack when he was writing a blog about the icon of Elijah, but not Avram's story. Instead, it was focused on the Alfred Hitchcock Presents episode. And so I thought it'd be really interesting to compare the adaptations. So I'm going to have him talk a little bit about the project that he's working on, and I'm just going to bring him on right now. Jack, thanks so much for joining.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the first thing I'd love for you to kind of explain to the audience is about the Alfred Hitchcock project, what it is, how you got involved. I think that'd be a great place to start.
Okay. Well, probably like a lot of people, I love the TV show Alfred Hitchcock Presents. I started watching it when I was a teenager back in the 70s. It was on reruns. Sometimes I would set my alarm for 2 a.m. and try and get up and watch it. And then I got involved in some other things, and I wrote a couple books on different authors. I wrote a book on Frederick Brown that came out in 93, wrote a book on Jack Finney that came out in 2006. And then in 2010, I was looking around on the internet and I found a blog that was talking about the TV show Thriller that had Boris Karloff. Mm-hmm. And I started reading that, and I got in touch with the people who ran it, and they invited me to write for their blog. And pretty soon I was writing about the Alfred Hitchcock TV show. And I started out with Frederick Brown, who I wrote the book about because he had written a bunch of episodes. And then I did a series on Robert Bloch, who wrote Psycho. And then I thought, you know what, I'll tackle the entire series. There's about 360 episodes. So I've been doing it for over 10 years. I'm up to about 280 something at this point. And at some point I decided just to call it the Hitchcock Project, for lack of a better name. And every other Thursday, a new article comes up on another episode. It's at barebonesez.blogspot.com. Or I think a lot of people just type in the episode name. It seems like when episodes air on MeTV or some other station, we get a lot of hits for that episode because people are just Googling it and looking it up. And that's how it started.
Wow.
I've got maybe three more years to go, I think, every 2 weeks.
So what are you going to do when you're done?
Well, I might try and make it into a book. I don't know. I don't, after that, I can't really imagine. I may just retire.
Well, I loved your blog. It was really insightful, and you know, it was very exciting when it popped up for me.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. No, now Avram, as you're aware, he actually had two of his stories turned into Alfred Hitchcock Presents episodes, two adaptations. The Icon of Elijah, which we're going to be discussing today, and then Thou Still Unravished Bride. And I was curious if you wanted to talk just briefly about Thou Still Unravished Bride before we get to the focus today, which will be Icon of Elijah.
Sure. I wrote about that one a while ago. It was also in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine in 1958, as you know.
Yep.
And it was actually on the Alfred Hitchcock Hour, which the Alfred Hitchcock Presents ran for 7 years, and then they turned it into an hour series for 3 years. And it was one of the last ones that aired in March of 1965. They changed a lot. They expanded it to make the short story into an hour-long episode and changed some things, I don't think, for the better. I think the story is better than the TV show. But probably the most interesting thing about it was one of the first roles for David Carradine, mm-hmm. who later became very famous, of course.
And Sally Kellerman as well. I mean, Hot Lips Houlihan from the original MASH. So Right. Obviously another recognizable face. In terms of, you've obviously watched a lot of Alfred Hitchcock Presents shows by now, and also seen the original stories. Is there a uniqueness to Avram, would you say, that you could pinpoint or discuss at least compared to some of the other authors?
I think so. Just based on that small sample size of two episodes, they both seem to have what I would describe as a haunting, almost a poetic quality to the stories that carries through in the TV versions. And at least with the icon of Elijah, there are some religious aspects to the story that are carried over in the TV show, which is unusual. There's not a lot of religious themes in the TV episodes. And also Icon of Elijah is one of a number of episodes of the show that sort of connect at least obliquely to the contemporary geopolitical situation. Mm-hmm. That didn't happen a lot, but it happened occasionally, usually something having to do with the British Empire and the Near East or the Middle East. And I thought that was interesting. And that's kind of unique out of the different shows.
Yeah, you know, we didn't talk about this, but as I've been doing my research and going through a lot of the Avram material, I definitely have found a couple of letters or articles that he wrote about his time in Cyprus. So he was there during kind of this time period. So I think I was able to add a little bit of value, I think, to
the story and authenticity. You can tell from reading it that he's familiar with it and he didn't just base it on research or something he read in a book. You could tell that he's been there from the way the story's written.
Well, you want to get into it?
Sure.
All right, let's do it.
The Icon of Elijah. Avram Davidson traveled far and wide, and his experiences provided inspiration for many lifetimes worth of writing. He was in Israel during the 1948 War of Independence, and afterward journeyed through Europe to London. His wanderings included Cyprus, where The Icon of Elijah is set. Cyprus is a small island in the eastern Mediterranean where Greeks, Turks, and other ancient cultures live in a constant state of simmering conflict, and there are always opportunists who are ready to make a profit from conflict. The Icon of Elijah appeared in 1956 and was one of Avram's first published stories. The editor at Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine commented, "Watch Mr. Davidson. He has the gift, the precious gift of words and insight." G.D. On a wet afternoon in early winter, a small and mud-splashed automobile entered Nicosia through the Paphos Gate and made its way through Sultan Solomon Square, Queen Irene Street, Ledra Street, and finally through a back alley which had neither name nor paving to speak of. Very few people in Cyprus were feeling cheerful in the cold rain, and the driver of the car, a heavy, jowled man with snowy hair, was certainly not one of them. He cursed the rain and the people thronging the narrow streets of the capital city, Greeks and Turks and Armenians and British, with superb impartiality. But in a low voice. Drawing to a stop about halfway up the alley, he blew two short, hard blasts on his car horn and struggled out, breathing heavily. A door opened in the stone wall to the right, and a man wearing the high boots and baggy black pantaloons, still favored by Cypriots of the older generation, hurried out. He had few teeth, and gray stubble covered his cheeks and chin. "More floods in the foothills, Kyrios," he said. "People and cattle drowned, houses washed away. I wish the whole damned island would wash away. Be quiet, park the car. I won't need it again today." "Yes, Mr. Copius." The houseman folded himself into the little vehicle and maneuvered it slowly away, while Mr. Carpius entered the back garden of his house and closed the door behind him. The garden was not well kept, the interests of the master of the house presumably lying elsewhere, Tiles clinked loosely under his rapid feet. Unpruned shrubs grew to the size of small trees. Moss was everywhere. The ground floor windows were barred, as were the second floor windows. There was no third floor, but if there were, and if it had windows, they would certainly have been barred too, for Mr. Carpius was a cautious man. He let himself into the house with two keys and passed through an enormous and shadowy kitchen where an old woman dressed all in black was feeding chestnut wood into an ancient stove. She mumbled a greeting over her shoulder, and Mr. Carpius, sniffing the aroma of lamb pilaf and stuffed grape leaves, permitted himself a little smile of anticipation and blessed her fulsomely. After unlocking and locking the doors of three more rooms and passing through, Mr. Carpius came at length to a small shop fronting on a fairly busy street. His eyes flickered rapidly around it, looking for a moment with pleasure on the window. Mr. Carpius, Antiques and Objets d'Art, and came to rest on a small, dark Maltese, who had once broken into a smile of obsequious welcome.
"What news, Paul?"
Mr. Carpius asked, sitting in a rush-bottomed chair.
"Another terrible flood, sir."
"Oh, damn it. Besides, I've already heard it from the houseman. What news?"
"Yes, sir. I understand, sir. Pray excuse me.
Ah,
Mr. Harare has bought the bronze camel bells. All of them. He says he can use many more. Camel bells are popular now. In Israel, he says. They hang them on the walls."
"Why, sir?" "Who cares why? Let them hang them around their necks, if they please, as long as they buy them. What else?"
"The parchment Sanjek map."
"Good, good."
Mr. Carpius moved slightly, a Delusinian period dagger which lay near the edge of the table.
"What else?"
"And all six of the silver denarii of Tiberius, sir."
"Excellent. I'm very pleased, Paul,"
Mr. Carpius said benignly. Paul writhed in gratification. A sudden afterthought struck his employer.
"At what price is marked?"
he snapped.
"Ah, yes, sir," Paul assured him in haste. "Minus the usual 10% deduction for dealers," he added nervously, but Carpius waved aside the usual 10% deduction.
"That's all right. And you, sir, Mr. Carpius, did you have good luck?"
Mr. Carpius's heavy, square face, usually pink, now darkened to a mulberry red. He scowled and clenched his teeth.
"No, damn it, I didn't."
Paul backed away and began to arrange a trayful of strings of amber beads, the sort of which pious Muslims used to recite the 99 attributes of the Almighty, beginning with his compassion, a quality in which Mr. Carpius was lamentably deficient.
"Let them alone,"
Carpius barked. Paul dropped one, then fell to his knees. After swallowing what seemed to be something large and dry, and beating his stubby-fingered hand on his knee several times, Carpius finally composed himself.
"I arrived there with the £20 that Iohannidis had agreed on," he said, "although I was naturally prepared to go much higher. The situation appeared made to order. The chapel had been closed for so many years, he'd had to break the lock to get in. The place hadn't been entered since the diocese leased the estate to the agricultural department before the First World War. Imagine it!"
Carpius leaned forward, furious, then went on.
"An icon of Saint Mummus riding his lion, 11th century work, and the silver cover showing details of his life from the reign of Isaac Comnenus, the last Greek ruler of Cyprus. Fabulous, priceless. One dare hardly estimate the value. I should have forced him to let me take it away the first time I saw it. A petty clerk in the agricultural department. How dared he refuse to trust me? And what happened when I got back there? After driving to the end of the island, it was gone. Could have throttled him. 'What do you mean, gone? You've sold it, you scoundrel,' I said, but by and by I saw that he was telling me the truth. The bishop took it for safekeeping. For 40 years, the bishops didn't even know it was there. Didn't think about it, care about it. Now, just when I take an interest, so does the bishop. What we need bishops for at all is something I can't see. It's just this sort of thing which causes anti-clericalism.
Carpius sat back, breathing heavily, while Paul hardly breathed at all. Gradually, the angry color ebbed from the antique dealer's face.
Tomorrow, he said calmly, I shall see what can be done about arranging to have it stolen. If nothing can be done, and sometimes, alas, such is the case, I shall be obliged, he sighed, to offer to sell it on commission.
He rose, flicked on the lights, and walked over to the windows. He removed a small painting of a meditative bull in a peeling gilt frame and replaced it with a set of ivory and ebony chessmen, and had just stepped back to consider the effect when two men arrived in the front of the shop. Mr. Carpius muttered something short and rapid, then smiled broadly as the two men entered.
My dear, dear Mr. Calloust Cheirinkirian, he sang out, and Major...
Parslow, said the major, a thick-set, ruddy-faced man whose bulging chest was covered with rows of ribbons.
Hello, Carpius, said Mr. Calloust Cheirinkirian negligently.
He was a tall man in a grey astrakhan hat, and the same pelt showed at the cuffs and the collars of his shirt. He turned a clever, sallow, eagle face to the shop owner.
I've brought you a customer. Major Parslow is his regiment's treasurer, and he is looking for a piece of silver suitable for a farewell present to Colonel Egerton, who is being retired. Something heavy and hideous. The colonel's tastes leans towards the Edwardian, if not to say the Victorian. Nymphs with huge bosoms and massive buttocks supporting an inkwell in the form of St. Paul's Cathedral. That sort of rubbish, Carpius. Your sort of rubbish.
Mr. Cheirinkirian's sense of humor is famous, Carpius said bleakly.
Quite, Major Parslow said.
Carpius snapped his fingers.
Paul, he said.
Paul jumped, began to climb up a small ladder and take things down from shelves. Behind Carpius's face, various emotions seethed and bubbled. He hated the suave Armenian who had got the better of him in many a deal, and he hated him nonetheless for now deriding him through his merchandise. And yet he envied him with all his heart for daring to speak before Major Parslow with a boldness which he, Carpius, would never dare employ.
Offer him a fifth of what he asks, my dear Major, the tall man was saying, and certainly do not pay more than a third.
I am happy, said Carpius, to be of service to the Major. We British?
You? The major asked.
Paul came up holding, or rather clutching, an object consisting of two silver Scotchmen in kilts, standing on a slab of marble, and supporting a clock with several dials on its enormous face.
I was born, of all places, in Hong Kong, Carpius tittered, and naturally my being a British subject by birth is my most precious possession.
Next, of course, to your virtue, Cheirinkirian said.
Examine it well, Major. It is gruesome enough to please even Colonel Egerton, and it tells the time, the day, and the month, the year, and the phases of the moon.
I've just returned today, Carpius, from a visit to Thalassopolis, where I paid my respects to the bishop. A delightful man. He had me to tea.
Carpius glared, quivering.
He wanted my advice and counsel. Would you believe it, Carpius? An icon of St. Mammas of the 11th century and a silver cover dating from the reign of the Emperor Isaac Comnenus. Lovely, lovely. He had removed it, on my advice, from a neglected chapel in the hills. We came to terms. It is now in a bank vault. How lucky. I heard of it. Dear me, Carpius, you are pale.
The Armenian smiled coldly. Carpius stared at him, livid,
but he soon composed himself. Chirangirian gestured. "This sort of rubbish you have here," he said, "would have sold well to the old Turks. They had an unfailing taste for the worst in Western art. If indeed one may call it art, the Imperial Turks, the Imperial Russians, Major, they were faulty and even wicked. But when I recall the bloodbath and holocaust which followed their overthrow..." He sighed deeply. Carpius shrugged. He remembered the unrest in Russia and Asia Minor with affection. Business had never been so brisk before or since. The loot of 1,000 churches and monasteries passed through his hands. Perhaps those days might come again. Carpius gazed with sudden disgust around the crowded shop. It was rubbish. Chirangirian was right. He thought of jeweled crosses and golden communion spoons. One never knew what might happen with half the peoples of Asia ready for one another's throats. He let Major Parslow have, with barely a struggle, and at only 400% profit, a silver snuff mull in the shape of a ram's head, with carnelian eyes. When the top was lifted, a concealed music box played Rule Britannia. "Adio, Carpius," Chirangirian said with a crooked smile. "We shall meet at Philippi, though I personally prefer the Riviera. After you, dear Major." It was then time to close the shop. Paul put up the iron shutters and locked them, and was dismissed to the comfort of home and fireside, represented by his elder sister, a sharp-tongued spinster with a black mustache. Carpius turned his thoughts to old Eleftheria in the kitchen, or more exactly, to the lamb pilaf and the stuffed grape leaves. Briefly, he reflected that his dislike of his tall rival had put him in such emotional confusion that he had committed a great breach of custom. He had neglected to offer coffee, the sweet, thick, black coffee of the Levant, served in tiny cups with beaten brass lids, without which scarcely any business deal or social call in Cyprus is conducted. But his mind quickly left this embarrassing recollection and returned to supper and to the bottle of Commandaria which was to accompany it. And at this moment, someone knocked on the shop door. Carpius, about to switch off the lights, hesitated. Then he shrugged. "Who is there?" he called out. "The monk Theodorus," was the answer. "And what is it you wish?" "I have... That is, do you buy icons?" "One moment." Carpius began to unbolt the door. The chances were that the monk had some wretched modern daub to offer in the worst style of cigar box art. But no one ever knew. And besides, it was always well to make as many contacts with custodians of church property as possible. Carpius opened the door. The monk Theodorus entered diffidently. His blue cassock was worn and patched, but the long dark hair gathered in a bun at the back was glossy with health, and the fresh blood of youth was on his cheeks, where as yet an untrimmed beard grew sparsely. Looking into the monk's eyes, Carpius received a startling impression. They were not the eyes of social man. They were like the eyes of some untamed bird of the hills or seas, clear and bright and focused afar off. In the Greek church, whose priests may marry, the term of monk is applied to all celibate priests, including those in parish positions. But Carpius felt certain that Theodorus was not one of these. "Which is your monastery?" the dealer asked. "Saint Barnabas and Basil," the monk replied in a low voice. Carpius knit his forehead in thought. "Well, I don't believe I've ever heard of it," he said, and almost at once a vague shadow of memory arose, only to fade quickly. "It is a small monastery. Here is the icon." The young monk began to unwrap it from the piece of oilcloth. Carpius took it. His eyes widened, then narrowed. He lifted it close to his eyes, then to his nose, then examined it again.
The style was early Byzantine or late Hellenistic and depicted the prophet Elijah lifting a hand in benediction while standing in a fiery chariot drawn by fiery horses. The hands and face were that shade of gray which in the Eastern Church indicates sanctity. Across the top, in old Greek minuscules, was written, Prophetes Elias, ascending unto heaven. The legend along the bottom read, Painted by the hermit Procopius, to the glory of the thrice holy and for the salvation of his soul.
Why, the paint is hardly dry on it, Carpius said.
Yes, it is newly done, the monk admitted. But surely the paint is quite dry, yes?
He tested it. Carpius ignored the gesture. His mind moved warily, searching for the right words. He must not startle this shy creature. He must move warily. If what he thought was true...
I trust, he said cautiously, that proper care is being taken of the original. It is very old and very holy, he added hastily.
Oh, very holy, the monk agreed. In all Cyprus there is no holier icon. It is never left alone for a single moment. One monk is always engaged in prayer before it.
Very proper. What is the price of this copy?
The price was low enough, but Carpius automatically knocked a few piastres off it. He let the young monk depart, but not without asking his blessing. It was not the dealer's intention to make too great an impression the first time, but he wanted the impression to be a favorable one. That night, after supper, and while leisurely smoking a yellow Egyptian cigarette, he questioned old Eleftheria. The monastery of St. Barnabas in Basil? Oh, yes, she had heard of it, but she hardly knew what to say about it. It had not been built as a religious retreat. Originally, it was only a large farmhouse. She supposed that the monks were devout. They were always keeping fast days and fast periods to commemorate events everyone else had forgotten. They ate no meat, no fish, no eggs, no milk, no cheese. And they also mortified themselves with long vigils spent either on their feet or knees. But the fact was, they were heretics. Yes, they had thrown off the discipline of the Holy Orthodox and autocephalic Church of Cyprus, if such a thing could be believed. And why? Because of the calendar. When the archbishop had followed the four patriarchs in directing that the Gregorian calendar should be adopted so that the religious date should agree with the civil date, these monks had defied them. What, adopt the innovation of a Latin pope? Abandon the ancient Julian calendar, always used by the church? Never. So, of course, they had been put under the ban and had retreated to their monastery. They were very poor, few in number, and, worst of all, they were said to have opposed the Enosis movement. They had not desired union with the motherland because the Greek government had outlawed the Julian calendar sect in Greece. Carpius listened outwardly, but only outwardly, not very interested. But after Eleftheria had tottered off to bed, he took from the bookshelf a large illustrated volume, Spendlove's The Iconography of Cyprus, and rapidly turned the pages. Yes, it was mentioned there. Spendlove, the greatest authority on the religious art of the island, had seen it in 1905. He described the icon faithfully. But the monks, the icon had then been located in a monastery near Paphos, had not permitted him to photograph it or any of their other icons. Being as yet unconvinced, wrote Spendlove, that the camera is not an invention of the devil. They have very little sense of time. All the events of Christian history seem almost contemporary to them. Constantinople has fallen only yesterday, and Alexandria, I attribute this icon of Elijah to the Alexandrian school, only the day before. Hence, the reason why they do not seem to value this particular icon more than any other, despite its unquestionable age. Carpius wondered how it had got from where it was then to where it is now. But the point was not important, Probably it had simply been taken by one of the dissident monks. Since he was not going to buy it, he need not bother about a clear title. Carpius did wonder, though, why its present custodians obviously valued it more than its former owners did. He thought he knew the answer, and decided to waste no more time, to leave the next day. The monasteries of Cyprus, where so many traditions of earlier times still linger, are as open for travelers to lodge in as churches are open for them to pray in. Rooms are always kept for visitors' convenience. There's no charge made for this, or for meals, but it is customary for travelers to drop something in the pyx on leaving. Carpius, not particularly desiring to adopt the ascetic diet of the monks, brought along an ample supply of provisions. Canned delicacies, smoked meats, sweets, a bottle of rum. He did not know how long his stay would last, but business had fallen off so much because of the rains. Mr. Harari and Major Parslow had been the only decent customers in days, that his absence could hardly make things worse. He had not told Paul where he was going. Paul was dependable, but only up to a point. He babbled to his sister, and his sister had the longest tongue in Nicosia. Carpius would not be surprised if the sale of the icon of St. Mamas had not contributed quite a few pounds toward her dowry. Trust Chirangirian for that. Nor did Carpius desire to make himself conspicuous by taking his own car. He regretted that the railroad had been discontinued, but regrets were useless. Jolting from side to side in the small and crowded bus, the antique dealer regretted the absence of the railroad still more. The day was misty, the curves on the mountain roads were exceedingly sharp, and the driver's habit of taking one hand off the wheel to cross himself while making each turn did nothing at all for Carpius's peace of mind. The only gratification of the ride was that the other passengers were all too busy talking to one another to notice him. There was little logic in his desire to be inconspicuous, but he felt that in order to avoid the bad luck of the St. Mamas incident, he ought to go about this matter differently. There was so much more at stake this time. If the icon of the 11th century were so valuable, then the price of this earlier one almost transcended the power of estimation. For a while, Carpius managed to forget the bus. He thought of a villa in the south of France, a well-furnished flat in Paris, and a certain hotel in Switzerland, where he had once stayed briefly. Not a large hotel, but admirably appointed. In this pleasant dream, in which Cyprus, with its rains and mud, its turbulent population, and its few good resorts, crowded during the brief season with rich and vulgar Egyptians, played no part. Carpius remained until the bus stopped suddenly and jerkily at a crossroads store. All the passengers got off, chattering loudly, some to stretch their legs, some to use the sanitary facilities, some to get coffee, some because this was their stop. Carpius got off not quite last, his bundle under his arm. He suddenly realized he had been here before. The vague memory which the monk's words, St. Barnabas and Basil, had aroused in his mind was based on this single visit. While en route to the mountains one summer to sell a genuine forged Alma Tadema to a cotton pasha at one of the hotels, he had stopped here briefly. The day had been especially clear. Some distance down the smaller road, a path branched off and led to a large stone house a mile or so away. Idly, he asked what house it was and had been told the Monastery of St. Barnabas and Basil. The Pasha had bought the Alma Tadema. It was crowded with decorously semi-nude young men and women, the Pasha's own taste tending rather toward the latter, though by no means excluding the former. While the passengers trooped into the combination shop and cafe, Carpius faded away into the mist. He had bought his ticket to the end of the line, but he did not think his absence would be noted. Sticking closely to the side of the road, he came presently to the path he remembered. He was not used to carrying bundles, or, indeed, to walking more than very short distances. It was fortunate that the route lay downhill. In less time than he would have thought, the world lay wrapped in silence. No sound from the road reached him. The trees and bushes crowded close to the path. discharging part of their moist burden upon him as he brushed by. Head down, he trudged along, and hardly noticed when he entered the monastic grounds. He came face to face with the house and stopped abruptly. It was old and heavy and made of stone. The windows were few and narrow. Architecture was not Carpius's forte, but he thought that at least part of the structure dated from the reign of the Deleuzinian dynasty, the Latin kings of Cyprus, before the days in the island of Genoa and Venice, and poor lost Othello. Later additions to the house had copied the same style. The roofs, which were on several levels, were mostly large slabs of mossy stone. The walls would have to be thick to support their weight, and partly tiles, black with age. Carpius knew that he could not expect plumbing, running water, electric lights, or other features he had found in up-to-date, more prosperous monastic establishments. He viewed the lack of these conveniences with philosophical detachment. He could enjoy them later, in the south of France, in Paris, in the Berne Oberlande. To the monk who received him, he explained that he wanted to see the Archimandrite, or Father Superior. Only after presenting Carpius with a tray on which were a glass of water and a small dish of preserves, traditional symbols of hospitality, did the monk depart, his feet echoing on the stone floors until the sound of them died away. After a long time, the sound began again. The Father Superior was an old man with a vast, gray beard. Carpius stood up and bowed. The old man inclined his head. "Yesterday, Archimandrite, I bought from your monk, Theodorus, an icon of the prophet Elijah."
"Brother Theodorus, he has not yet returned. There was nothing wrong with the icon. Brother Constantine painted it."
"Oh, no," Carpius hastened to assure him. "It is a very good icon, but it has troubled me that he asked so little for it."
The Archimandrite said nothing, so Carpius decided to skip the gambit of offering to add to the price and continued.
"In fact, I scarcely slept the whole night. I kept thinking of the holy prophet and how he fled into the wilderness to escape the wickedness of the priests of his day and of the government."
The man looked up. There was a gleam of interest in his eyes.
"Surely, in a place where the priests do evil and the government supports them, the people are corrupted as well?"
The old man nodded slowly.
"When I consider the action of the archbishop in changing the calendar," Carpius went on, "I was troubled. But I said to myself, surely what this venerable and holy man does cannot be wrong."
The Archimandrite frowned, and Carpius hastily resumed.
"But last night it came to me, as if in a vision, that he was wrong. What right had he to tamper with the ancient traditions of the church, with the Julian calendar that was good enough for the fathers of the church? Origen, Polycarp, Ephraim of Edessa, and the others, and I was obliged to admit no right at all. The established church of Cyprus is now in a state of heresy, of apostasy. Its festivals are all on the wrong days, and hence are no festivals at all. Most reverend Archimandrite, I have come here to seek the true religion from you."
The old man's face was illuminated with joy. He stretched out his hands.
"My son," he said, in a voice tremulous with emotion, "you speak with the tongue of angels. You have not come here in vain."
Late that night, while Carpius was trying to compensate for the frugal supper of the monks with a late snack of deviled ham, biscuits, and brandy, he reviewed the situation. How right, how lucky and right he had been in his guess as to why the icon of Elijah was so venerated here. In the prophet of Israel, the short-tempered Tishbite, the dissident clerics of the monastery, saw the forerunner of their own order. As Elijah had denounced false worship, so had they. as Elijah had been obliged to flee into the wilderness from the anger of authority, so had they. The only thing Carpius had not calculated was the vision which the Archimandrite had had. With tears running from his eyes and protestations of his unworthiness, the old man described how, in a dream, Elijah appeared before him, chariot and all, holding out his mantle with the words, "Thou art cold, cover thyself." Actually, the monks were retreating from more than a change in calendar. They were retreating from the airplane and the jazz band and the hand grenade, the tumult and weary unrest of the present troubled age. Retreating from it and turning back to the long and deep slumber of Byzantium. Off on their side road, they need never even smell the fumes of an automobile. And deep in the cellar where the icon reposed, in a special tiny chapel, all to itself, no bigger than a dungeon cell, each monk in turn venerated upon his knees. They found the peace they sought, sweet and silent and heavy. Carpius took the copy of the icon from its wrapping and mentally compared it with the original. As to whether or not Spendlove had been correct in calling it Alexandrian, he could not say, but certainly it was Hellenistic. It had nothing of the rigidity or formalized stiffness which characterized later iconography. It was purely natural. Perhaps the monk Procopius, before his turning to the religious life, had painted many a late Roman patrician or tribune or matron. Perhaps he had even done bacchanalian scenes for the walls of some pagan tavern or villa. Putting speculation aside, Carpius rose and removed his shoes. Finding the stone floors cold to his feet, he added a second pair of socks. In one pocket went the copy painted by Brother Theodorus. In the other went a small bottle and a thick gauze pad. This might not be necessary. Very likely the monk on vigil would be dozing at this hour, in which case it would be the work of a few moments to make the exchange. But just in case, and if the bottle and gauze were needed, what then? They were always having visions, these monks. Let him make the most of this one when he recovered. In the dim light cast by the tiny lamp, no one could tell the difference between the old icon and the new. Silently, Carpius went through the corridors and down the steps, flashlight in hand. Here and there, a monk snored or breathed heavily in his sleep. Down, farther down, deep into the cellar, along a cold, cold hall, at last he saw ahead of him the pale glow of the tiny chapel lamp. He switched off his flashlight and crept slowly ahead. In the cell, a monk crouched on his knees, elbows resting on the floor, head buried in his hands. His breath came and went, smooth and even. Asleep, Carpius thought, inching forward. He reached out his hand for the icon, and in a moment, so swiftly that his eye retained no image of an intermediate picture, the monk was on his feet, howling wildly and grappling with him.
Satan! The monk shrieked. Father of lies and of thieves!
He's an old man, Carpius thought. How does he have the strength to shout like that? And with his free hand, Carpius lifted the heavy flashlight and struck. Then, looking at the monk lying there, another thought came to him. Lines from something he had once read, something an Englishman had written. Who would have thought the old man had so much blood in him? Perhaps the struggle had taken longer than it seemed. Perhaps he stood there longer than he thought. But when he looked up, he saw them at the door. Carpius stood there, stupidly, motionless. He heard their voices, saw them lift the body, felt the cold seeping through his stockinged feet. One syllable began to beat in his head like a pulse. Why? Why? Why?
Why? Asked the Archimandrite. Why did you kill Brother Damianos?
I didn't mean to. He saw me reach for the icon. I didn't mean to. I am very sorry. Believe me.
His mind was clearing now. Swiftly, it darted this way and that, seeking a point of escape.
I only wanted to look at the icon, but he thought I came to steal it. He took me by the throat and I was frightened.
He dropped to his knees and clutched the Father Superior's hand.
"Do not turn me over to the police. It was an accident."
"An accident," murmured the old man. The monks muttered and crossed themselves.
"Moses appointed cities of refuge for the manslayer to flee to," the Archimandrite said. "Sanctuaries for those who had killed accidentally. You say you are sorry? I shall choose to believe you."
The Archimandrite disengaged his hands.
"Oh, thank you. Thank you," Carpius said.
The monks moved backward, moved away from him, away from the blood.
"We shall not call the police," the old man said, "but you must pray. Pray for divine forgiveness. You must repent. Pray without ceasing."
"I shall," Carpius rose.
It had been easy after all. He turned to pick up the icon, hiding it by standing between it and the monks. The copy lay on the floor beside the original. He slipped the real one in his pocket. A grating noise interrupted him. He turned to see the door swing shut. A key clattered in the lock. He looked through a small opening in the door. It was a thick door, bound with iron. He pressed his face to the opening, not understanding.
"Pray without ceasing," the Archimandrite repeated. "We shall bring you food and water twice a day, and oil for the lamp. We shall feed you as the ravens fed Elijah. As long as you live, we shall feed you, and you must pray for forgiveness."
They moved away. Carpius stared at the walls around him. The roof was made of stone. He had noticed that. In order to support such a heavy roof, the walls must be very strong and thick.
So what'd you think?
I thought it was great. I thought it was a really well done production. And I have some thoughts about the story too.
Yeah. I mean, for me, how do you think the story, I'm fascinated by adaptations. I mean, to me, it is where I'd love to see some of Avram's stories go, some of his, you know, some more adaptations. And I feel, I'd be curious about your take and the differences. And I recommend, by the way, everyone go out and watch this as well and listen. I think they're both fascinating. But how are they different? What do you see as big differences between the two?
Well, between the story and the TV show, the TV show, it's very faithful to the story. Mm-hmm. But one of the big differences is the character of, she's the cook in the story, she's an old woman. And in the TV show, they turn her into a beautiful young woman, mm-hmm. who I think is supposed to be Carpius's wife. It's never said outright, but that's implied. And she obviously wants things. She wants money. He wants to give her things. And this gives him a motive to steal the icon that he doesn't have in the story. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. And then the character of Chiringirian, who is sort of his cohort in crime almost, who brings the British man to the antique shop, but you can tell in the background that they're working together to con him. He also, in the TV show, he pulls Carpius aside and says he has a client who wants an icon that's very, very precious, and he doesn't really care where it comes from. That's not in the story either. And I think that gives Carpius another motive, a financial motive beyond what he has in the story.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, obviously, in an adaptation, you have to make the stakes really high. And so the higher we were, and in the story, you can decide what you want to do. Obviously, it can be very different. But yeah, I mean, I think in the Hitchcock episode, they made the stakes a little bit higher than they are in the in Avram's actual story. I mean, is that kind of?
I think that's true. I think another thing they do very well is they split the show, and it falls naturally with the commercial in the middle. They split it into two sections, and the first section is really the secular world, where Carpius is in his antique shop and he's doing his business. And then the second section, he's in, I would call, the sacred world of the monastery. And they eliminate the long section in the story where he takes the bus from his town out into the country to the monastery. Mm-hmm. It just ends the first act with him deciding he's going to go there. And the second act, he's knocking on the front door. So you don't have that transition between the two worlds, that gradual transition, which I think is interesting. But I think it really makes a nice contrast between the two worlds.
Yeah. And again, I imagine you can't, it'd be tough to make an, to have a bus ride, it'd be a little bit harder to make that exciting in a film or a TV show. So I get it. It makes sense.
The other big change I'm sure you saw was when he is at the monastery at night, his efforts to steal the icon are expanded. You see him in his room sort of biding his time. I think it's midnight. He goes out for the first time. One of the monks follows him.
Yeah.
There's sort of struggle and he's caught and he has to sort of slink back to his room. And then 2 a.m. comes and he tries again. And this time he goes in and the monk is asleep. And instead of hitting him with the flashlight, like he does in the story, he takes one of the candlesticks.
Yeah.
Him, which I thought was interesting because it's almost more like he's taking a sacred object and using it for this horrible thing.
Yeah.
And at the end, if you noticed, when the Archimandrite tells him that he needs to pray and get over what he's done, in the story, he turns around and tries to steal the icon and trade the fake one for the real one. So he's completely not doing the right thing. But in a TV show, he nods and kneels down and starts praying. It's very different. He at least gives the impression that he's trying to be forgiven. But the end is still that tremendous, very subtle scene with him closed and locked in. And he's looking out the window of the door. And he almost seems puzzled. Like he figures, all my cons have always worked before. Why didn't it work this time? And here he is now. He's been tried and found guilty and sentenced to life in a prison cell, just the way he would have in the secular world, by this Father Superior who has been presented as almost a naive, innocent person who has suddenly turned the tables on him. It's just wonderful, both in the story and the show.
Yeah, no, I agree. If you were going to make an adaptation of the Icon of Elijah today, and your two options are a feature film or a TV series, I mean, and you can do it however you want, but what do you think would be different today? What do you think you would change, or how would you go about doing that if you could do it? What did you have any thoughts on that?
I did. I think that if you set it today, you could still use the antique shop because that really hasn't changed all that much. But I think you would need to work in the internet and cell phones, because dealers in antiques today rely on both. They rely on the internet to search for things, to search for values, to sell what they have. And the cell phone, I think we've seen in TV and movies, telephones are always important and very visible. And I think you could focus on the difference between the modern world now that he's in with the online searching and selling and using his cell phone to contact people. And then he goes out to the monastery. And for instance, there's no internet service. His cell phone doesn't work. He can't do anything. He's suddenly back in the past. And I think that might make for an interesting contrast that would be very jarring for the character.
I like it. Wow. Yeah, that's great. Who would you have play Carpius? If you could choose an actor, any thoughts on who you might have play Carpius?
I did. I came up with three. And I really thought, because I think you need somebody who can be a convincing anti-hero, somebody who is both likable but also believable as first a con artist and second a murderer who's completely unrepentant.
Right.
And the people I thought of were maybe Hugh Laurie from House.
Okay. Ooh. Yeah.
He might be able to play both sides.
I like that.
Danny DeVito. I don't know if he could do the series. I think he can do serious roles, and he kind of reminds me of Oscar Homolka, who was in the TV show.
Yeah.
And there's a show on PBS right now called Guilt with a guy named Mark Bonner. If you've never seen it, you could look him up. He would also be perfect for it, I think.
I love it. I love it.
Thoughts I had.
Wow. I really like that idea. I can't thank you enough. I mean, this is amazing. I'll definitely keep track of what you're working on. Is there anything else that you'd want to add or something that we maybe missed?
No, just to encourage people to keep reading these stories and hunting up any TV or movie adaptations of Davidson's work. I think it's definitely worth looking at, even all these years after it was written.
I cannot thank you enough. And maybe we'll have to do another one of these down the road for Thou Still Unravished Bride.
Sure, I'd love to.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
It sounds like a story to me. Some crazy fable that you would not believe.